tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 451 of the Tsunami Escape Podcast. I'm C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Seda.
Hello.
And Crocodile.
Good evening.
Welcome back, guys, for another rundown of the Tsunami block. We have a couple of news items we'll start out with real quick. The first is we did get a full-on promo for the Thousand Year Blood War Season 3, which is going to be premiering this weekend. And I do have a choice quote from the promo that kind of made me chuckle. It was very Bleach, where Yuhavaha says, "The real battle begins now," as if everything else we've been seeing is not the real battle.
Everything else is just fake shit. Pretend this is the real deal, posers.
Yeah, we'll get into this show in a minute, but I will say that you guys were talking last week about like the show feeling very Bleach, and I'm like, I wasn't really sure what you meant by that, but having seen this most recent episode, like I completely get it now. It's like the good guys are winning, and then they're losing, and then they're winning, and then they're losing.
But it's not like a natural progression. It's just like they keep flipping on and off their like one-upmanship switch.
Yeah. I don't know if like ass pull is the correct terminology, but it kind of feels like that might be the correct terminology. Like everybody has a gimmick that's like, I'm out gimmicking your gimmick.
Yeah, something like that.
Still pretty funny though, or fun. What'd you guys think of the promo?
I actually did not see it.
Okay.
Oh, I mean, it was perfectly fine. Like it kind of shows you some of the, I mean, it's the least surprising thing ever because I think everyone watching this on Tsunami, even if you hadn't seen it before, was aware that this season was not the final season and even the next season not the final season. So this should not be surprising in the least. But, you know, I thought it did its purpose well of being a Bleach-ass promo and showing lots of dudes yelling at each other and saying Japanese-sounding names as they shoot laser beams from their swords and their fists and their bows and arrows.
You mean Bleach.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, one quick question before I move on. So, Thousand Year Blood War Season 3 is airing this weekend. There's a Thousand Year Blood War Season 4 that's going to be premiering in Japan soon, right?
We believe sometime in the first half or the first quarter of next year.
Will that be the final season, though?
Of this arc. There is some hubbubaloo that there might be the famed Hell arc or whatever that Kubo's had been tinting at for forever. And because there has been material that takes place chronologically after this arc that's been published in light novels. So there's been some murmurings that they'll like actually take that and canonize it and make more anime afterwards. But that's not confirmed. They might be more insight on that next month in Japan. But the next season 4, should be the last season of this arc, which is the last canonical arc of Bleach so far right now. Hint, hint, wink, wink, we'll see.
Okay, interesting. So yeah, the next, after 3, when we get to 4, that's technically the end of the manga. But there could be more, is what you're saying.
Right. And also, it's likely that Season 4 will add a lot that was not in the manga. Because I think it's pretty commonly agreed upon that the manga ending was kind of shitty. Probably because Kubo might have been feeling rushed or his health might have been failing. You know how mangas basically work themselves to death, you know, either literally or almost literally. But now he's obviously in a much better place, mentally, physically, health, you know, health-wise, whatnot. And so far in seasons 1, 2, and 3, there's been kind of more and more added to like rectify mistakes of the manga itself. So given how much manga there's left, there doesn't appear to be actually enough manga left to do an entire 12 to 13 or 40 episodes. But if you add in a lot more stuff, fix some things, you know, then you can buffer it out pretty easily to a full season and hopefully, you know, make it much more satisfying of an ending.
Cool.
I knew that this was like the end of the manga, but I didn't realize that I guess the story still kind of continues anyway in light novels or whatnot. I thought it was just kind of the end. Although I was aware that it seemed like, if I'm reaching back into my memory, that it seemed like the ending, the fact that it ended now, was maybe not necessarily Kubo's like decision. His publisher just decided it has to end like this now. So,
Crocodile, do you know if the light novel extension stuff is like chronologically taking place after the end of the manga?
I have not read that material or personally consumed it, but from my understanding of, like, you know, looking at the over conversations about it and just kind of being in the general cultural osmosis of Bleach and other shonen anime, my understanding is that this is mostly like epilogue material, that it does take place after the Thousand Blood Year, this arc. So, like, it is like material that chronology takes place afterwards. And I'm not sure if that, I think the Hell arc, I'm not sure if that's the same thing as some of the epilogue material in the these light novels. They might be separate materials, and they might both take place after this arc or something of that sort. I'm not entirely sure 100% about the details about everything, but I know at least some of the material takes place after this arc. I'm not sure if all the material out there that may or may not become anime would take place after this arc or not, but at least I know some of it does.
Maybe they'll air the Burn the Witch anime on Toonami.
Yeah, I'm not sure where that takes place relative to Bleach, because I know it's the same universe, but I'm not sure if it's like co-current with like Bleach or like a prequel or sequel. I just know it's in the same universe.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned it. The other piece of news we have is very brief, but might as well mention it, and that is that it was announced the release date for the new season 3 of Primal, will be coming out on January 11th. And it'll be at 11:30 p.m. So that, I believe, is a Sunday.
Yeah, that makes sense for most Adult Swim premieres.
Yeah, my guess is that Primal Season 3 will just air on Adult Swim normally, like an Adult Swim show. But I imagine it'll eventually get like an encore run through on Toonami. It'll fill a slot, whether that's later in 2026 or even 2027. Eventually, I think it will. Gotcha.
Yeah, that's been the pattern of previous Primal seasons. It was the same thing with Common Side Effects, though. That was kind of, obviously, Common Side Effects was more them buying time. Granted, it happened to be an excellent show, but that was definitely more of a buying time, whereas Primal has history of being on Toonami, just usually not premiering on Toonami.
Okay, well, that's it for the news. So let's move on to the block, and we will go directly in to Bleach. Bleach, The Thousand-Year Blood War, Core 2, Episode 13. This is the final episode of this core. The title of this episode is Black. So my first note here is that we start the episode off, and Yuhavaha is basically gloating about the fact that everything belongs to him, apparently. I don't know what he's talking about here, but he's like, everything is mine. This world is mine.
There is some baby of legend or something that he's either is or a part of or something. I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know if it's explained fully.
All right. Well, we'll find out, I guess. Him saying it right now just felt really like
villain cliches.
Yeah, it just sounded like he's egotistical. So this episode starts out, everyone is fighting. All of the Royal Court guards are fighting the main Sternritters. I'm not going to go over every fight. I will highlight a couple here. X uses a new move that he has called X-Axis, where he describes that he can shoot holes in people, and he goes into detail about the fact that he's not actually shooting bullets. He's just shooting a sort of force, so you can't like dodge or deflect.
Oh, you talk about Lily Barr, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The sniper guy.
Yeah, I just call him X because it's way easier to remember. His name is whatever his real name is. Like that. It's actually very convenient that Kubo gave all of these Sternritters a letter. So I'm going to use that.
Yep.
Although maybe I'll go back and forth. Meanwhile, Yuhavaha is fighting Ichibei up in the upper level. And Ichibei's got his like big paintbrush. And he breaks out what's called his black attack. It's like he calls it black. That's the name of the episode. And he basically paints Yuhavaha's sword black. Whenever he paints something black, it loses its name. It becomes a nameless thing, which means that, like, Yuhavaha can't use his sword now because he doesn't know the name of his sword.
I guess there's a lot of power in names.
I mean,
I suppose
there kind of is, actually. Obviously, this is kind of nonsensical, but in a weird way, the ability to name things and the names of things actually do hold a lot of meaning in kind of a weird philosophical way. Like, I don't know, in terms of history and world events and titles, like, names mean a lot. Like, our names, your names, like, I guess names do kind of mean a lot. But this is still all, like, Bleach nonsense, so it's kind of that balancing act, I guess. I don't know.
Well, it's like just, I think it's just metaphysical here. We're just kind of dealing with, like, big ideas main manifest. So, like, it's like, if you forget something name, it has no power. Like, it's that kind of idea made real, so... But anyway, so yeah, he's kind of stunned for the moment. Meanwhile, back down in the lower area, my notes here are very... you guys feel free to, if you want to, elaborate. But the court guards were doing really good. They were doing a lot of damage. But then they weren't. Suddenly, the Stern Ritters start turning on them, and they become very powerful and start getting defeated.
Right. I mean, the Auschwalen was kind of gave everyone Raze and Mighty Guard and Haste and all that jazz. So that's pretty much... what was going on, the Royal Guard were putting... not the Royal Guard. The Squad Zero... Okay, so Squad Zero versus Royal Guard. Because the Royal Guard for the Quincy's are distinct from the Royal Guard that were kind of defending the Cerate. So I think we should just say Squad Zero versus the Royal Guard to help distinguish that rather than getting Royal Guard all confused amongst yourselves. But yeah, that was pretty much the Royal Guard.
So Squad Zero is not a Royal Guard?
Well... they are, but, like, they also have their own name of Squad Zero, and that helps distinguish it between the Quincy's, who are the Royal Guard of Yobawe. So rather than saying Royal Guard of the Shinigami versus Royal Guard of the Quincy's, I think if you just say the Squad Zero versus Royal Guard, that makes things less confusing. Does that make sense? That's how I keep it in my head. Like, rather than Royal Guard versus Royal Guard, Squad Zero versus Royal Guard.
Okay. So Yuhavaha's Royal Guard.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So like I said, now they're powered up. And so, I mean, they were powered up at the beginning of the episode and they were doing some damage, but then Squad Zero started coming back and then the Yuhavaha's Royal Guard came back again. This is what I was talking about earlier. I don't know if this was it was earlier when I was talking about the whole back and forth of Bleach, but yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of like ping-ponging about, you know, who has the upper hand. And it doesn't necessarily feel like a natural, you know, back and forth. It's just kind of like, now we're winning. And, you know, sometimes the rules don't really make sense in Bleach, but that's fine, I guess.
Yeah. I think that's just the way the show is and the way the power scaling and everything.
I think the one thing I did think was funny was that, I guess since you were mentioning Lily Barrow, was that when, I'm forgetting his name, the swords master from the Squad Zero. Yeah, he was taunting.
It's like Oyatsu.
I believe so. He was taunting Lily, saying he's trying to get in between him and Yuubawa, because he was like, you can't shoot me, because you try to shoot me, you'll just hit Yuubawa. But then Lily shoots anyway, saying that his ex-axis makes sure he can never miss his target. And the implication was that since the Shinigami was his target and not Yuubawa, his bullets, quote-unquote, would never pass through his initial target to hit an ally. They only just hit his target, which is obviously kind of the Shinigami. So that I thought it was kind of a bit of... that was like Swords Master being kind of smart, you know, putting himself in the line of fire of an ally so that his enemy wouldn't shoot. But then Lily was like, it doesn't matter, my only target is you. So like, aha, like, so, you know, I thought it was actually kind of one of the more clever bits of aha, ha, ha, aha, ha, 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 you know, yeah. That was going on. So I just pointed that out. But yeah, I thought that was kind of a little fun.
It was kind of like you misunderstand how my power works and, you know, that's your fault. And it's like, no, that actually makes sense. The way he explained it was nothing can get in the way between his bullet and his target. Which that literally true, and if there's someone behind the target, it doesn't matter, because that's not how the power works. So,
yeah, I think that, like, I don't want to give the wrong impression because I say I'm skimming over these fights. Like, it doesn't mean that I don't enjoy watching these things unfold. I do. It's just a lot happened. So it's too much to, like, go over everything.
Especially when we get into this, especially when we get to Ichibei's black ink stuff that he does later.
Like, yeah. But, like, I think I genuinely think that this is Kubo having fun with ideas, and it is kind of fun to watch that, I agree. Even if it is very, like, back and forth and kind of sometimes a little bullshit, it is kind of fun to be like, ah, my power works this way. It's almost like Hunter x Hunter a little bit in the way that they had there. What was their powers called? I forget.
You mean Nen abilities?
Nen, yeah, they're Nen abilities, yeah. Similar, where there's, like, rules and stuff. Okay, so we come back from the commercial break, and the Squad Zero have another trick up their sleeve, and this one's a big one. So they all kind of kneel down and start harming themselves, which breaks some kind of pact that they had where they were limiting their abilities.
They don't harm themselves. They kill themselves. Everyone except Senshimaru kills himself to release a seal that lets one of them use their Bankai. So all the Squad Member Zeros are dead. They didn't harm themselves. They kill themselves.
Now, are they, like, dead? Are they?
Yeah, I was going to say, I question dead, but I'll go with what you're saying. Because death in this world is very confusing.
Sure, that's fair, but to be clear, their intent is not self-harm. Their intent is suicide.
They're willing to give up their life for this move.
Right.
They do it very casually. Okay, I'm trying to get the name here. Give me one sec. Oyetsu is like, okay, Sentomaru, you're up. You're the one who's going to defeat them all. Or Senjumaru, you're going to defeat them all. And he kind of says it very, like, in a way that's like, oh, you know, we've done this before, which is why I was confused that you're telling me they're going to kill themselves, because that's very finite. But again, maybe that's just their resolve. But yeah, so they all kill themselves except for her. And this, yeah, like you said, it allows her to go Bankai, which is the first time we've heard one of these characters say that.
Yeah.
It's pretty incredible. Like,
it's like a super Bankai.
She does her move, and they literally say this, and then we see it, that it shakes all three worlds. The human world, the Shinigami world, and the upper heaven world. All of them, like, rumble with power. Yeah, it's shaking everything, and, like, we see, like, cutaways where it's happening, and it's crazy.
So, for Senjumaru's Bankai, I'm going to post a part of her wiki entry on, like, all the different names of her Bankai. I think there's a minor spoiler in here, but that's fine. So, like, her Bankai has a name, and then, like, the ability itself has a separate name, and then there's, like, a different name for each of, like, the tapestries that she uses that each has, like, its own ability that depends on who the target is. So there's a lot of names, and I'm not even going to try
a mouthful, to, like, pronounce all, like, of these. She went on to, like,
No, I posted it, but it's going to be zoomed out. I can fix it. But yeah, there's just a lot of names. So it gets kind of confusing.
Yeah, I'm gonna read one of them. This is the name of her Bankai, okay? Strap in. Shatatsu Kagura Shigarami no Tsuji. And, like, she says the whole thing.
That voice actress really put the work in. That's a mouthful.
Earning their pay in this episode, for sure. But, okay, and there's a long sequence. It's very cool. And she basically, one after the other, uses a different technique to just defeat all of the the royal guards.
Yeah, the four royal guard Quincy's, as well as, like, the two, like, arms of Yahabaha, Jugrum and Ishida, like, all six of them. So they're all getting attacked by a different ability. And, you know, so, like, for example, one of the abilities is called, like, Hitokase Tokuba Banra no Me, and then there's Futakase Tokuba Hagane no Yoroi, Mitsu Kase Tokuba, and so on and so forth. Like, each of these has, like, its own name. And I assume they translate, this wiki page does say, like, what they translate to, like, Eyes of Many Branches, or Armor of Blade Metal, Battles of Black Sand, Freezing Bed Linens. So, like, all of these have, like, these are, you know, just kind of literal translations of what she's saying. But yeah, she's voice actor is going through all of these different you know, kind of sub-abilities of her Bankai that allows her to kind of counter each character one by one. And this takes, like, several minutes to go through all of this.
Yeah, it's like 5 minutes. And it's, yeah, and I mean, it's very epic and it's very cool. And it's just what I was thinking when this is over with, what this sequence is over with, and she's defeated all of them, I'm just thinking to myself, okay, this is one of Squad Zero's Bankais, and it just defeated all of the top Royal Guards. And I'm thinking to myself, what the hell is Ichigo going to do? I mean, come on.
He's got two swords now.
He's got to do, someone's got to clean up, right? Someone's got to get the broom out and get the bleach. Oh,
but that's the thing. I'm not so stupid to think that he isn't going to be the ultimate winner, like the ultimate most powerful. How can he be better than this?
Because it's bleach, we know that, like, this is clearly isn't over and Ichigo's going to get his turn. If the previews didn't already tell us, we knew this was bleach. But at least, to be fair, if this was Hunter x Hunter, like, Gon and Killua are the main characters, but they are not the most powerful characters in the show at all. So, like, in other shonen, the main character isn't necessarily the most powerful one or the one who gets all the trophies and whatnot. But that's not what Bleach is. But
okay. You know. I just have a feeling that Ichigo is going to do something more powerful than this, and I'm going to be like, what?
Well, powerful, maybe more powerful, but certainly not as cool, because all Ichigo does is, like, shoot sword beams, right? That's not nearly... You can shoot a sword beam that cuts a planet in half. That's still not as cool as what Senjimaru did. Even if it's more powerful, yeah. Quote-unquote.
I mean, he's just some dude. And these guys are, like, gods, practically. Anyway.
Also, just some cool... There's some cool, like, animation effects and colors in the sequence, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some nice use of CG, too, with all the cloth stuff. I thought that looked good. Well, back up to the Ichibei versus Yuhavaha fight. And Ichibei, I guess, did not take his life. He's still up and doing his stuff. And he is like, all right. And in a similar way as Senjimaru, he's like, okay, now I'm going to put you down. And here's what I'm going to do. So he paints Yuhavaha black. Remember, he had cut his name in half. Now he just has no name. And then he says, I'm so powerful, I'm going to give you a new name. Your name is Black Ant. And you are nothing. You're nothing but an insect to me. And then he pushes him off the platform. And then two giant hands just come in and crush him like he's like an ant.
You are literally, not literally, but kind of literally a bug now.
Something like that. Yeah.
Because I named you as, like, such?
Not only can he take away a name, he can rename you, rename a thing, and give it, like, I guess, the weakness of an ant.
There is a funny sequence or a funny, like, shot in this part where, like, Yuhavaha is all, like, ink covered in black ink, but except for his, like, eye.
Yeah.
I think at this point is where Ichibei has said he's basically activated his Bankai, but it's not called a Bankai because his thing was... Before there was ever a Bankai, he goes, yeah, you know, yada yada yada. Before and beyond all the Soul Reapers, but he basically, this is his version of Bankai, basically. And so,
I think he even says, yeah, like, this would be a Bankai maybe if that was a thing when this was developed or however.
Yeah, when he created this, it created before Bankais were a thing. Yeah, very cool, and it's very powerful. And I mean, obviously, for the moment. Yuhavaha has been defeated by these guys and he is falling his way back down to the Sarate. We get the credits and then we get something extra at the end of the credits. It's Kon. He is here to make jokes and make us laugh after all this serious stuff that's happened. Now, he keeps calling himself the King of New York. Is that something new or has he always done that?
I'm going to be honest, I don't remember that.
I don't recall him being a candidate in the recent mayoral election, so I'm going to call foul on that.
Okay. But is that what Kon stands for, I guess? K-O-N? Like, I don't remember that.
No, I think he's just, I think he's just shitting, like, bullshitting.
Okay.
Kon does that. I don't know if he's ever called himself the King of New York before, but he likes to puff himself up in, like, I'm the most important guy, everyone worship me, and yada, yada, yada. He does that a lot. I don't know if you've ever called himself the King of New York before, but he...
Yeah, well, he does, two or three times in this segment.
Yeah, I knew he was bullshitting, but I just don't remember if he brought up this bullshit before or not.
Yeah, is it... King of New York is very specific. Why New York? Anyway. So yeah, he says he's going to bring back this special feature called the Illustrated Guide to Soul Reapers, which appears to be a kind of omake sort of like comedy skit that would be at the back of a manga. And that's what we get. We get like two of these.
There have been a few of these gag segments before in Bleach proper, which is just like random, just like this, just random nonsense with silly jokes and the main characters doing dumb shit. And like, yeah, so this is not, this segment is not new, but it just hasn't been a thing for a long while.
It's fine. I mean, like, there was a gag about like Renji, like, peeping on Rukia or something, or thinking about it.
I was a little confused about that section because they're like, we have to get stripped naked by Senjumaru, who's going to like measure us. And then they were like, you're not thinking about me naked, right? It's like, it was a little bit confusing.
Yeah, I think, like, yeah, I think
what they meant.
I think, yeah, that happened to Rukia. And then like, she was in distraught about what happened. And Renji was like, well, because we know Renji has a crush on Rukia. Like, that's not hidden knowledge. Like, she brings that up and then he like starts thinking about it. And she's like, don't you fucking dare think about that. And then it basically happens, the reverse happens to him in the next segment. And so he, now he's the one who's like, oh my God, what happened to me and stuff like that. And then there's also that segment of Mayuri and Ichigo talking about Bankais, and then Pono's just being annoying twat during the whole thing. And
yeah, they fourth wall break and it's like, you're not allowed to cut in here this into this panel, into this conversation and stuff like that. So yeah, just a little bit of lightheartedness, I guess, because we haven't had any opportunity to have any comedy in this show for a while now.
I also think they need to fill time because they can't really proceed even like a few moments further than the narrative because that would no longer be a good, clean season break because other shit happens that I won't go into, but you can probably figure out given the preview we already saw. So I think they just want to stall for time, and this was a funny way to do it.
I know listeners can't see this, but I just posted a GIF of one of the omakes of a previous episode where Byakuya and some other guy are like, just keep flash-stepping each other, where they keep warping behind each other.
Oh yeah, I think he's just as a joke. He's the seventh Espada, I think. I forget his name, but yeah.
They just kind of poke fun at the edit. You know, the anime
this
poking
is,
fun at the
this
manga.
Is almost so. an animated GIF representation of Bleach. In the whole, like, I'm outdoing you, you're outdoing me kind of
thing. Flash step behind you, like, nothing personal, kid, and just over and over and over again.
Yeah, I've got the upper hand. No, I've got the upper hand, and just rinse and repeat. All right, and that's Bleach. Anything else you guys want to mention about this episode before we move on? All right.
I don't think
Doesn't
so.
Sound like it.
I think we're good.
That's pretty much it. That was the final episode for this core.
As CeeLo would say, show's over. Good evening, everyone. Have a good time.
Yeah, Yohabaha is the I guess they're just going to have to end the show now. He's been defeated.
It's two more seasons of King of New York Con just, you know, hamming it up.
Yeah.
It's not a comedy.
We never got to see Ichigo's power up. All right. Well, let's move on to Blue Exorcist. Blue Exorcist, Beyond the Snow Saga, Episode 3, Hometown. This episode starts out with a brief flashback of Shura as a little girl in Aomori, which is that snowy area. And she was kind of like, almost like a homeless person or something. Like she didn't have anyone caring for her. And Shiro, who is Rin's dad, was there from True Cross and came and rescued her. So we see that like brief flashback.
Yeah, and they during this section, like I think they're, I forget if it's Mephisto that says this or in this first part of this episode, they reveal that like basically the True Cross, you know, exorcist took Shura in when she was 9, and that was 18 years ago. She's 27 now, and that age is important later.
Yes, good point. We cut back to the scene we saw at the end of the previous episode where Yukio and Rin are in Mephisto's office. Mephisto is going to send them out to Aomori to go look up and find out what's going on with Shura. However, he also openly tells Yukio that he knows something's up with Yukio. He's got his eye on him. He knows Yukio's got a secret. So I'm kind of wondering if that person we saw spying on Yukio was spying for Mephisto.
Yeah, maybe. And he even says, like, he kind of, like, slyly, not so slyly, says, like, training is fine, but as long as it's not life-threatening, hint, hint.
Which surprises Rin.
Yeah.
Well, they arrive in, Rin and Yukio arrive in Amori, and they get to the inn that they're going to be staying at, which has this little old lady with one big round eye, and her other eye is kind of obscured by her hair. And we kind of have a running gag here where she mistakes them as two, like, lovers who are going to stay at the night in her inn. And so she keeps trying to accommodate that.
Yeah, Yukio's not very amused by this. Rin either doesn't even realize this or just doesn't care.
Well, Rin clearly doesn't realize it.
Like, I'm just here for a good time.
Yeah, Rin, this clearly is going over Rin's head, but yeah.
Well, they decide to relax in the hot spring, and then they have a talk about Shimmy, where Rin kind of openly, he tells Yukio what had happened in the basement with Shimmy, and then also asks, you know, Yukio is like, well, I thought she liked you. Does she not like you? She said she just wants to be our friends. So they kind of have this talk about Shimmy.
I mean, I think Rin asks for some clarity in the situation. Yukio, do you like Shimmy like that? Like, he just wants to know, which I think is totally fair on Rin's part, but Yukio deflects the question. Now, granted, I think it's pretty clear that Yukio doesn't feel about Shimmy in that sort of romantic way, but he doesn't really answer the question here, so Rin's kind of left wanting for an answer.
Right.
Throughout this section, Rin is actually being fairly mature.
Oh, yeah.
Where he's, in, you know, for the type of hothead that character that he has been, like, it's kind of, you know, nice that he's being thoughtful with his own feelings as well as with Yukio on a variety of things. Like, he's like, you know, he admits that he likes Shimmy, but he's like, well, if she doesn't have feelings for me, then that's that, right? Like, and she's just wondering, do you have feelings for her? And kind of just working through it. And then also during this sequence and also later on, like when they're going to sleep, he's kind of just telling Yukio, like, hey, I know, you know, something's bothering you. I can tell you're keeping a secret. You know, your thoughts are your own, but, you know, I'm always here. I'm here if you need me. You know, I'm here to support you, type of thing. Being a pretty good big brother, really.
He even says, I'm your big bro. You can tell me anything.
It's even, like, Yuki was frustrated by, like, God damn it, Rin. Stop being a fucking, like, adult and, you know, like, he doesn't say anything, but you can tell from Yuko's expression, even in the context of that scene that Seiya described, that Yukio is, like, frustrated that Rin is just being such the bigger man about this whole thing. Like, he obviously knows Rin is completely correct. I mean, sure, I'm sure Yuko is still gonna do his, like, try to activate the demon eyes thing, be reckless and whatnot, but just Rin, he knows Rin is right, and it just pisses him the hell off.
It's frustrating to watch Yukio kind of sit there, because then the camera pans over, and Rin's like, are you asleep? And he doesn't get a response, and he's just like, okay. And then the camera pans over, and we do see that he's awake and just gritting his teeth. And it's like, come on, man. I don't understand why. I mean, I get it. It's like the tables have flipped, and now Rin's the adult, and Yukio's being a little childish. It's a little, I don't know why they've gone this, like, so far in this direction. I don't even think they're that far different in age. I mean, maybe like a year? I don't know.
Are they twins? I forget.
Oh, I don't know. Maybe. It just seems he's just being so, I don't understand what's in it for him to not talk about this.
Pride, I think, is he talks about how he wants to be stronger than Rin, and I think a lot of it is just his pride. Because he's always been kind of like the, like, obviously he's always been the younger brother, but he's always kind of played the big brother role, so to speak. But obviously the tables have turned, and so now that kind of frustrates him. And then there's also this whole thing, like, what the fuck is going on with these demon eyes? And so I think it's just a lot of a combination of pride, frustration, jealousy, resentment. Like, all a smorgasbord of negative emotions are kind of swelling up in his head, and it's clouding his judgment.
So meanwhile, Shura, we do catch up with Shura, and she's out in the snow forest, and she's meeting up with a dude who has lots of eyes on his face. He's got all these snakes around him, and his name is Hachitoro, and then that's when we cut to commercial break. When we come back, we learn that Hachitoro, who I believe is a demon or the demon that she's made a pact with. I think it's the demon she's made a pact with.
Well, technically one that our ancestor did, but I'm sure we'll get into that
shortly. Correct. Yeah. Yeah. I'll get into that. Go ahead.
He's kind of like an immortal Hydra. They call him Hydra and also Naga at some point, which is all like snake demon. But they emphasize that he's like immortal or all powerful, which kind of goes into what we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. especially C. Kohler, about like the Illuminati are going after like this, you know, beings that have some sense of immortality, whether it's the Phoenix, the nine-tailed fox, now this snake guy. So
I'm curious if he's like connected to the same lore of the eight-headed Orochi snake demon from Japanese mythology. I'm not sure if he's like
I know what you're referring thing. To, but I don't know if they're like right.
Yeah, I don't know if it's the same thing or just kind of related or whatnot, but yeah.
So I'll kind of I'm going to skip around a little bit because in the order of the episode, things get revealed across multiple scenes, but I'll kind of combine it here for brevity. Right. Basically, Hachitoro, who she calls Hachiro for short, has demanded that Shura have a child. They kind of have a fight, and then she loses. And then it's revealed, and this is when she basically explains to Rin and Yukio that her ancestor, which is like, I don't know, about four or five generations removed, made a pact or made a deal with Hachitoro in the past, and to have like his tooth become that sword that she pulls out of her chest. But in return, the demon wanted for her to always be bound to him. And so there were like two outcomes from this. One is that the girl would never grow old, or he never wanted to see her old. So she has a limited lifespan. She can only live to the age of 30. And two, the other condition is that she would always have a child before that date, and then that child would be born with the same abilities. Not just that, the same appearance. So all of these generations of girls have looked exactly like Shura.
I think the hair color has been a little different, but essentially, yeah. Because I think when you make the pact, like so, we've known for a while that Shura is basically descended from a line of ninjas. That's not a new revelation, but I think the first ancestor of her who made this pact, like bluish hair. Then she makes the pact with Hachitoro, and then part of her hair turns red. But then, like of course, Shura is like golden red, which is obviously so. There's just changing in hair color. I'm not sure if that's like maybe something to do with like successive generations that happened or whatnot. But besides that, they basically look all alike. And I don't know. I always thought it was a little weird because if you're a mortal demon, why, if you just want to see someone look young forever, just give them some of your demon cells as opposed to kill them off before the age? Well, first of all, 30 is really young. I'm sure, you know, back then, maybe however many generations ago, like life expectancy was shorter. But, you know, you could still be, if the demon just wants to a bang hot, like, human assistant or whatever, like, she would still look awesome into her 50s, you know, if she took care of herself or whatever, even, you know, 60s or whatever. Like, I don't know. It's just...
Are you trying to ask whether a demon would do something that's good? It's a demon, man.
No, I'm just saying, there's so many, like, this demon pack, it seems like the deal gets worse all the time, and we're just so used to demon packs being a thing in so many on anime and manga. And oftentimes, like, I will make a pact for a demon so I can have like immortal life or immortal youth or whatever, or eternal youth or whatever. That's extremely common, not just in Japanese mythology, but in mythologies across the world. They don't tend to just cut your life short. You just say, okay, you can now live to be 300 years old, but you just look like you're still 30, as opposed to, oh, you hit 30, your heart explodes now. It's just, what a shitty deal, like.
But again, I think like that's part of the demon aspect of it. And also, I don't exactly remember, and we don't need to go into it, but I don't remember exactly why she wanted to make the deal outside of getting the sword. I don't know if it was like
I think it was just purely for power.
Yeah.
For the ancestor. It was like, in exchange for abilities and power, then, and the sword, you can have it, but now you'll die when you're 30, and you have to have a kid before then. And Shura is the first, I guess, in a line that is kind of like, you know, what happens if she denies that part of the pact? Like, what are you going to do if I don't have a kid before I die? Like, what are you going to do about it? And what is he going to do about it? I don't know.
There's also the question, which is never really answered, which is kind of disconcerting to think about. But who is supposed to be the father? Like, is she supposed to find another human to have a child with? Or is, like, Hachitaro, like, supposed to be the father? Like, couldn't he? Like, I don't know.
It seems like it's not necessarily him. It could just be anyone. Agree.
But then it shouldn't he be the one to do it? It which is obviously has the problematic elements of
like if he watched, like,
it's obviously very problematic. But like, she's like, yes, he be the one to do it though. If it this pact is supposed to make any sense, again putting aside the problematic elements of that arrangement, she just hopes she finds someone to fall in love with, or just maybe I don't know. A lot of this doesn't make sense to me. Maybe in future episodes explain it better, but.
But yeah, but I guess being, you know, serious, like, okay, part of the pact was that it was kind of like this sense of, it was this kind of the sense of like this never ending pact. Like, you must always have a kid before you're 30. But like, or else what? Like, it just dies with her bloodline if she doesn't have a kid? Like, what's the consequence if she doesn't?
I think that is the case, honestly, Seda, and I think that's why she's so resolved to let it happen. She makes a very good point to Rin, and this is the end of the episode, so I might as well just talk about it quickly, is that she basically, well, there was a funny bit real quick here where she's like, I'm 19, and she makes like a funny face, and you are not 19, but anyway.
And also, there's also a part where she's like, I'm going to die, I'm not going to pop out a kid. And that was like the way she phrased it.
But she's like, I think she's kind of resolved to end the cycle kind of thing. And she's just like, I'm not going to do it. But she is also believes and that she's going to die. This makes Rin very mad because Shura has accepted her fate that she's going to just die at 30. And she's just going to, she's like, that's fine. That's just my life. And Rin just really gets mad at her about this. And he's like, you can't just give up like that. That's not right. They go off. Rin and Yukio go off for a moment to talk amongst themselves. But when they come back, we see that Shura is missing. She's left. And we don't know where she went. And that's where the episode ends.
We need Luffy here to ask her that to have her say that she wants to live.
What's your dream?
I guess we are building up to some kind of moment of that sort. Like, that's like, clearly this arc is not going to be end of I do not believe for a second this arc is going to be end of Shura. So however she gets out of this contract, like, we are building up to some sort of moment like that. I mean, not necessarily as cathartic as that iconic One Piece moment, but we're clearly building up towards something like that.
Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah, and I hope, I like her character a lot, so I don't want her to leave or die or anything like that. So I'm hoping she stays. I have high hopes. I mean, I have high expectations that she'll stay. I don't know if she'll continue to keep her power because it's completely derived from this demon. So we'll see about that. But yeah, that is this episode. I think I like this episode quite a bit. And I think it's because a lot of it focused on Shura. And I think the scene with Rin and Yukio at the hot spring and afterwards when they were going to bed, I thought that conversation was really good as well. Great character development, I think, particularly for Rin.
It's forthright and kind of mature in a way you don't see a lot of shonen. A lot of these type of series have characters beat around the bush. Here, they're just talking to, well, I guess more it's Rin talking at Yukio than rather than talking to each other. But even still, just one person being like, hey, dude, let's just be like human adults here and just like talk things out, or at least try to, and just rationalize, like be rational about this. And so it's kind of just refreshing from Rune's perspective, especially since, as you already mentioned, he's the basically hot-headed shonen hero archetype. So it's not what you never hear Luffy speak like this, for example. Like, no. Never hear Naruto, at least maybe in Boruto, but you never hear Naruto from the context of Naruto speak like this. Like, he has his talk no jutsu moments, but even still, he doesn't really talk like this. Ichigo doesn't really talk like this. Like,
this is the most Rin has felt adult to me in the entire series. Like, right. He is, like, when he talks about being Yukio's older brother, this is like the moment where I realize, yeah, he is. He definitely is the older brother here.
I feel like eventually, you know, Rin and Shiemi will hook up. I feel feels inevitable. I might be wrong. They might throw a curveball. But, like, I feel like a lot of shonen protagonists who do have this sort of, like, romance element, they kind of feel like, they kind of, like, play it up for jokes almost. Where, like, for example, Naruto for the longest time has a crush on Sakura. And he's just kind of like, notice me, Sakura, notice me. And it's kind of goofy and silly and whatnot. But this is a more mature, like, he acknowledges that he has feelings for Shiemi, and he's kind of like thinking to himself, like, well, if she doesn't, you know, reciprocate those feelings, then I have to deal with that. That's just how it is. And he's just kind of working through that. And other protagonists wouldn't necessarily do that.
Well, they wouldn't even try. They would just, they'd have these jokes, and then all of a sudden epilogue, oh, they're married and have kids. And it was just like, where was the whole romance the past like 13 years? We need to see some of that.
Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood is one of my favorite animes, and it does this.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else with this before we move on?
Yeah, the only other thing I would say is that the contours of this deal, I feel like we need to learn more, because I feel like this doesn't entirely make sense, but it could just be we just don't know all the details yet, because we just introduced the concept in this episode, so there's a lot of time left to delve into it a little further. But yeah, I just feel like there's some elements that need explanation, but I guess I think we'll just get them eventually.
And also, we'll have to see how the Illuminati come into play here. Like right now, they're sort of on the fringes of this little story that we're entering here, but they're gonna make a move and do something here.
Yeah, and as far as the deal and the, I feel like if it is just the demon got what he wanted and Shura's ancestor was just greedy, that's satisfying enough for me. Like, I don't need it to be anything more than that.
I guess I'm a little puzzled why. I get why the ancestor who made the deal, at least I get some of the logic, not all of it, but some of it. You're desperate, you're being hunted down by your former clan. I kind of can get that. I'm a little puzzled as to why the future descendants played along with it and only Shura's one to be like, if I don't do the deal, what's the consequence? How did no one else think of that? That kind of puzzles me. But again, maybe we get more details filled in later. So, but
yeah, let's just hold our breath on that, because you're right. I think that might come. I mean, there's going to be a turn at some point that will probably explain that. Okay, well, let's move on to actual comedy on the block. Mashal. Mashal, Season 2, Episode 3, Rain, Ames, and God's Gift. This episode's not named after Mash, which I thought was kind of neat. All right. We do get some pretty epic Rain, Ames action in this episode. Quick rundown. Margaret, we learn, is actually the prefect of Orca Dorm. There are three dorms at Easton Magic Academy, and they all have prefects. Again, this is very, like, you know, European Hogwarts kind of thing. He's one of them. And then we come back to the scene that we saw at the end of the last episode, the battle, right before the battle breaks out between Margaret and Rain Ames. Margaret sits down and starts playing the piano and just plays the piano for like a minute and a half and then stops, and that's it. Even Rain is kind of like, okay, what was that for?
This feels like a handicap if this is something you have to do to prepare for battle or something.
It's very odd. Yeah. After the little performance, we cut away briefly over, and I guess Mash and his friends are still at his dad's house, and they're playing this sort of wizard's board game.
It looks like they're playing a game of life.
Basically, that's what I thought too, yeah.
And just everyone rolls kind of something appropriate to them, like Lemon rolls like, you're a stalker, and Lemon's like, fuck you, game. And Lance rolls, your sister comes home with her boyfriend, and Lance like, fuck you, game. And then I think, what happens to the Firehead? Was he play? I forget what happens to him. I remember Mash plays, and then everyone finds that you don't have magic, and you're executed, and Kate said like multiple times, and stresses him out. And then I think
I forget what happened to Dot, but Finn is just kind of like, you turned in like a lost and found and got money, and he's like, oh, that's nice.
Oh yeah, his is extremely like normal.
I guess that's the point of his character. He's the most normal character of all these people. We cut back and we have the big battle has begun, And it's actually really great looking. Like, the animation here is full on Sakuga looking good.
Yeah, there's a few cubes.
Flux style cubes, yeah. Yeah, they flux style.
Dynamic camera angles, flowing motion. I mean, you know, clapping. Props to the animation team. They made Mashal look really good here.
Yeah, and during this sequence, you're probably getting to this, there's kind of like cutaways to the headmaster talking to the redhead kind of like exposition, like student wizard. They have a name, but I forget what the name is. But they're explaining about third lines.
So conveniently, and for no reason whatsoever, just out of the blue, just having a conversation with third lines for who knows what reason whatsoever, just on a whim.
So this character's name is Exposition Coon. This redhead.
He does have a name. They did this. I think this was the first time they said it. They did say it in this episode for the first. When they said it, I'm like, oh my god, they got a name. And then I noticed also when they showed the opening. By the way, they had a mine. The opening was edited slightly for this airing. It wasn't edited a lot, but it was edited down slightly.
It was like the first five and the first and last 5 seconds were like cut or something, but everything else remained, which was really weird.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was, if you're going to cut it at all, that was a good way to do it, but it was surprising they did it at all because it wasn't very much. However, my point being is that the big haired kid that we're talking about is in the opening. I'm like, oh, he's there
he's
too.
He's dancing too. Like, I think even like Gaara is in there dancing too. It's kind of surreal if you pay attention.
So yeah, Dumbledore here is saying, like, you know, the one thing you don't know is that there's only one student who's been the youngest person in the world to ever have God's gift of a third line. These are truly God's chosen people. And then we cut back to the battle, and we see Rain, who has always had just two lines on his face, starts to have a crying tear come out of his left eye, and then it draws a third line on his face. And he's got three lines now.
So they kind of imply that, like, a third line, while very, very rare, is something you can, like, achieve with, I don't know, kind of a mix of talent and effort. It's not necessarily clear to me if a third line is just something that, you know, you were either born with or not, or like you maybe have the potential to get one, but you may not necessarily reach that.
I think for Rain, the issue was that he was so young that he had, not that he had one, which was obviously still noteworthy, but he was so young that he had one. I think that's what makes him extra special.
So I was wondering in the past, like how many lines you had was just, you know, just a factor of your birth. Like, you have two lines and that is it, or you have one line and that is it. This seems like you can somehow manifest an additional line.
Well, it has to be because of what you're saying. Like, how can you be the youngest to have a third line if you aren't born with it?
Yeah, so that's what I'm getting at is, and like, I'm wondering, can a one line person develop a second line, or is that, you know, just something that's like a hard cap that you're either born with it or not? I'm not sure.
I mean, I will say that the line that came onto his face didn't look like his other lines. It was very scraggly and broken.
Right. Maybe the third line works differently than the first
and
two.
Also, the third line disappeared after the battle was over. So it was like, it was like him going Super Saiyan as opposed to a new default.
Yeah. So while this is happening, Mash, who has kind of ran away from the party for a moment to go eat a cream puff in solidarity or whatever, happens to see the battle nearby and is watching this, and he hears Rain talking about the fact that Mash is going to change the world, that he has the opportunity to prove the world is wrong about nomadges or muggles or whatever they're called.
Lack of magics, I think they're called.
Lack magics,
thank you. I think that's a funny word. So he's kind of like silently watching and is impressed. We get to the commercial break, and when we come back, Dumbledore also explains that triple liners can do something that no other mages can do. They can fully awaken the power of their wands. Their wands can take their true form, which we immediately then see, of course. This is, I think, deliberately comical for these exposition scenes to be cutting in right when these things are happening.
I know this is a writing trope. I don't know the name, but this is very something. I'm sure there's an entry in TV tropes for this very specific writing trope.
Yeah, I have a feeling the author was doing it on purpose I guess it could just be the trope. I don't know. So but anyway, it's happening.
You mean a general trope where something is introduced as soon as it's relevant?
Yes.
Like,
And it's like, we're laughing at it because it's so coincidental, and this is a comedy manga, but also it is very common for this to happen, even in non-comedy mangas.
Is the writer
being
funny or is the writer a hack? That's the question we're trying to figure out.
Or the writer just doing what others do. I don't know. It could be. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and say he's doing it for comedy because the big haired guy's there as well, and that makes me laugh. But his wand transforms and he shoots a super powerful blast at Margaret, and Margaret is literally blown away and just leaves like a One Punch Man style, like, lying in the ground, or like a crevice in front of them.
Rain leaves a crater in the ground, basically. And I mean, I think Margaret Dodge, she actually, in a rare demonstration of compassion and empathy, Margaret prioritized saving his minions as over continuing to fight. So he was injured, but he ran. He basically hieced out so he could save his minions from being like basically murdered by that attack. And then he kind of goes off to lick his wounds and whatnot. But that's, I think, the first time we see Margaret show empathy towards anyone else or anything else. So
they're two assistants. They've got them like under their arms and like carrying them because they like got knocked out. They're sort of protecting them, and they're otherwise fine, and they get away. Mash takes that moment to thank Rain for standing up for him, which he's really, really genuine about in a way. It's not like done in a jokey way at all. It's very serious. He then goes back to his house and has a dinner with his dad, and he also thanks his dad because his dad's like, I wish you could have had a normal life. And he just stops him and he says, I love my life. I love you. I love this. I'm fine. Thank you for everything you've done. And like, it's just real serious Mash in these moments.
It went from an orphan child to like, he has friends and family and like, you know, he's about to be put to death. But like, other than that, I mean, there are actually a lot of things going okay in his life. So he has stuff to be thankful, even with the whole sword of Damocles on his neck.
Mash is an orphan, right?
Yes.
Like, this isn't his real dad.
No, his adopted father. Remember back when his father was about to kill himself? Because he was, like, so weak in magic. Like, he had magic, but he was weak. He felt worthless. Everyone was rejecting him in his life. So his dad was about to kill himself. And then before he did, he found Mash crying in, a bundle or a stroller. Not a stroller, but, like, a basket. And decided to save Mash. And then that kind of symbiotic relationship, he had something to live for to take care of this lost child, and so he didn't kill himself. He raised Mash and so on and so forth.
Okay. Well, this is when the narrator steps in and starts giving us some more lore. It's time to learn about the Triwizard Tournament. I mean, the tournament to be the Divine Visionary. And there are three stages to becoming a Divine Visionary. The first is you have to have enough coins. You have to have earned enough coins. Second, you have to then compete in the Divine Visionary tournament, and then there's going to be a final exam. And back at the dorm room, Mash has a lot of coins, and he decides to make sure that everyone has three coins, that he wants all his friends to have the three coins so that they can all be part of the exam. Then we cut over to the arena, and we see that.
Except Lemon.
I was going to say, except Lemon. For some reason.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Of course, he didn't notice. No one noticed Lemon.
Yeah, the four guys get a chance. First of all, I think Dot's going to become a Divine Visionary. Like, I think he's got it in the bag. That's a joke. But Lemon doesn't get to participate. She's in the stands.
Okay. Well, that seems very on brand for this show. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, my understanding was that, I think we may have discussed this before, but my understanding is that editors forced Lemon into the series just to have like some female presence. And so the author just barely uses her because they don't have really any ideas for her. That's my understanding of what went down.
I believe that. Yeah. I believe that it seems perfectly logical to me that the author of Mashal wanted to just have a character literally beating the shit out of wizards. And there wouldn't really be a point of having a character like Lemon in that story. But I get that they needed like, oh, let's have, you know. There's got to be at least one female character.
I mean, even with Lemon, the gender balance is a little bit lopsided.
Exactly. Exactly.
So,
anyway, we cut over to the exam arena, and we see that there are going to be 12 entrants. Some we've seen before, of course. On his way to the arena, though, Mash gets stopped by the head bad guy. I forget his
Orter.
Name. Orter. Thank you.
Orter.
What's a weird name. And he's basically there to tell Mash that, you know, the world cannot tolerate a lack magic like you. You must be destroyed. I will do everything in my power. I'll make it my life's mission to kill you. And you will never defeat me in this, and you're going to lose your life and all this stuff like that. And then Mash is just like, he just starts talking to his muscles. He's like, he's got names for all his muscles.
One thing I also noticed in this scene is Orter is pretty tall. He's like considerably taller than Mash. Yeah.
Well, I think Mash is also, isn't Mash also kind of short, or?
I didn't think so.
I don't know.
Maybe. I mean, he's very lanky. But
I didn't really consider Mash to be tall, but like just in this shot, there's just a couple shots where it made it clear, like, oh, Orter's got, you know, several inches on Mash.
Yeah.
I don't know if it matters. Okay. I just noticed it.
I'll keep my eye out for that. I didn't notice that, but yeah. Well, anyway, Mash's muscles all encourage him. I guess he voices them.
I mean, I think they were just his friends before. I mean, remember that Mash was raised in his father in isolation because Mash was a lack of magic, and so he didn't want Mash to get murdered. So Mash didn't really have any friends until pretty recently. So I think he just named his muscles as they were his substitute friends because he was raised a child of no friends.
Yep. Yeah, agreed. And as he walks into the arena, he starts getting booed by everybody. Oh, boo, it's the lack magic. Everyone hates him. And the master of ceremonies kind of girl kind of like explains that the first test for the arena exam is going to be to get a key. They all have to get a key. So that's where the episode ends.
Well, also having to fight off Minotaurs, which I think is worth mentioning because Finn freaks out when he learns about that, understandably.
They kind of ramped up to it. It was like, you need to find a key. Well, that's not so bad. It's in like a little like pouch that you need to destroy. Well, that's not too bad. And you're going to be being chased by three bloodthirsty killing Minotaurs. And then he's like, yeah, and then he freaks out.
So yeah, that's this episode. I thought this episode was pretty good. I liked it.
I thought the running gags of the Game of Life was probably the comedic peak of the episode. But I think for what Mashal does, I agree that this episode was pretty good. Mashing in this master ways. I don't know. I'm trying to figure ways.
It has all the characters are very gimmicky, and the little Game of Life kind of plays into each character's gimmick. And I guess even Finn has a gimmick of not having a gimmick. Like, he's just the normal one, and that is his gimmick. And then we have, you know, some sort of serious stakes with this Divine Visionary tournament contest. Oh, I don't know. It's still too, a pretty good balance for me. And the animation during the battle was good. You know, I think it's still meeting a good balance of just like comedy, but not too serious, but not like just enough seriousness that there's something to latch onto versus where nothing matters. I don't know. I'm still enjoying it enough for what it is.
I think one of the saving graces for the series parts is that I wasn't expecting Rain to be such a pro Mashal guy. So having that be a thing, I was like, oh, I'm kind of pleasantly surprised by that, that he's really standing up for him. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, it's not completely Mash versus the world. He's got some powerful
Everyone's
friends.
Not a Nazi in this show, just way too many people.
Yeah. Right. And and then I agree with you, Seda, that I feel like the balance here is pretty good. We get some serious stuff here and there, but then we always get jokes as well, so.
Yeah. Speaking of Nazis, was the Brad in this episode or was it in a previous one that we just showed up like out of the blue? The cop guy, remember him?
He was in the previous episode.
Previous one? All right.
Yeah, we joked. You weren't on the show at that point, but we were joking about the fact that I guess he just hangs around Mash's dad's house all the time.
Yeah, it's very weird how they have like a friendship and like the ending's cut off. So you can't really see it, but they show up a lot in ending too, and it's kind of like, oh, I guess they're just best buds now, which is just really fucking weird. That doesn't really make any sense, but I guess it just is what it is.
It's a goofy ending too.
They're just driving a bunch of like sports car.
Yeah, everybody's driving sports cars in like the nighttime in Tokyo, and then the joke at the end is that Mashal's out pushing his car.
Yeah. Oh, so you did watch the you got a chance to watch endings. Yeah. Yeah. It's a pretty good ending. But it's like yeah, it's just weird, but Spoopy. In a good way. But yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to the last show of the block, One Piece. One Piece, episode 753, A Deadly Elephant Climb, a great adventure on the back of the giant elephant. Yes, that is the first half of this episode. We are climbing up the elephant's leg. Although, before we begin the episode, we get a brand new Great Pirate Era intro.
Yes, I noticed this. I mean, it's broadly the same, you know, concept that we learned before. Did they give a name to where the One Piece is?
Laugh Tale.
They did, yeah.
Now, is that the first time that's been said?
Well, okay, I'm going to be really careful here because you guys, okay.
Okay, so here's my perspective. In the intro, the narrator says, like, the One Piece is located at this place. And I'm like, I did not know that. Either I forgot that, maybe it was said before, but I forgot, or that's just new information.
So I think it was said before that the log poses all eventually lead to one particular island. Like, there are multiple ways to get there, but they all lead to one final island, which is, I think, where the One Piece is supposed to be and where Gold Roger went to. I think that's been mentioned. I don't think the name Laughing Tail has been mentioned before, but I think the existence of an island that Gold Roger
I can answer the question. So the answer is that, yes, they had been named before. The problem is, I don't know if you watched with subtitles. It's the name of the island has always been referred to as Raftel with an R.
Oh, Japanese R is always weird between Japanese and English.
Yeah.
Well, it's also kind of like how you hear like Alabasta, but sometimes it's spelled Arabasta anyways, even though it's spelled with an R. Like I oftentimes see it spelled Arabasta, but they say Alabasta with like an L sound. So anyone who's read or watched any Japanese media knows that L's and R's are kind of like a similar sound in Japanese. So they're kind of switched, you know, or used interchangeably almost. So I guess this is another one of those situations.
Kind of. It's more than that. I don't want to go into it, but I will just say that up until this stupid airing where they named it something else, it was always called Raftel. Okay. Huh. And I will just leave it at that. And you can just let your mind wander. But anyway. Okay, so yeah, after the Great Pirate Era intro, we see everyone is riding on the back of this poorly drawn dragon. They decide to name it Ryunosuke.
Ryunosuke.
That's why he kept saying Ryu, Ryu all the time. He gets up about like halfway, maybe to like the knee, but then slides back down all the way back down to the water's edge again.
I just assume it's toy filler, right? Just toy stretching.
I'm not sure, actually. It might be. Kind of felt like it to me, too.
From what I can tell, the most important part of the first part of this episode is that some sort of monkey thing is falling from the back of the elephant and just bumps into the two samurais and knocks them off.
Didn't he also say, like, you're not welcome here, like, get out, foreigners? Like, wasn't he screaming, like, build a wall, it was just falling down or something?
Something like that.
Correct.
Oh, I skipped over your second note.
Yeah, I was going to say, right before that, though, it was probably worth mentioning this because I think it is important.
Yes.
That they're asking, why are you guys so interested in coming here? And he says, well, you know, of course, we need to meet back up with Mononosuke, but that's not the only reason. And Kanjiro, who's the guy who looks like a kabuki actor, he explains, we're actually looking for someone else, a ninja named Raizo, which everybody gets really excited and they're like, oh, ninja, can he do
except
this?
Robin does not give a flying shit about ninjas, apparently. She only gives a shit about Ryunosuke and his cuteness.
Yes, exactly.
So I assume this is Oda doing more of his really weird gender jokes where men love robots and women hate them kind of thing. That's what it seems like to me. I think, I don't know, maybe. I've never been a fan of that stuff, but I guess that's what he's doing here still.
Even Law is like, can he do, like, shadow clones? You know, stuff like that.
I actually don't mind this, where it's just kind of like, you know, boys loving these sorts of things. And it's just kind of like, sure, if you're going to make a gender joke, I think this is probably the most harmless type of gender joke, where it's just like boys obsessed over ninjas and robots. Sometimes
I feel like it's just, he always plays it this one same way. I feel like at least switch it up occasionally would make it all play better, I guess, or like...
Yeah, he doesn't do it enough. I mean, he has done it. Like, think of Tashigi, for example. Like, she's big into swords. That's not common.
And then, unfortunately, all of her whole crew doesn't treat her very well.
Right.
Right.
She doesn't really get to do anything. But, yeah, it doesn't happen on that.
Oh, I think someone mentioned in the thread that Naruto in the manga was ending around this time, that this was happening in the One Piece manga. So I think there was some mention about, like, maybe Oda is throwing a bone to, like, oh, everyone loves ninjas because look at all this ninja shit going on in, like, a context of Shonen Jump. I think I heard someone mention that in the thread, but...
Anyway, they say that they're going to look for this guy named Raizo. And then that's when the monkey falls down and knocks them off. They fall off, but we've learned that they must have caught themselves or something. They didn't fall all the way into the water. If they had, they'd be dead.
And they're both devil fruit users, right? So they both
Right, drown. Exactly. Yeah. That's what I mean. So, like, they must have, like, caught on, but they just go on without us. We'll catch up to you, is what they say. After we get, like, some time passes, Ryunosuke is still climbing. Luffy is asleep. He ends up falling off and then uses his, like, long arms to grab on Ryunosuke, almost pulls Ryunosuke off in a, like, unnecessary Luffy way where it's like, dude, don't be an asshole. But he does it anyway because he's Luffy. And he's just like, you can do it, Ryunosuke. It's like, you're the fucking problem, dude. Stop pulling on him. Anyway, they make it up.
And then there's a big, like, sequence here where they're like, you can do it. And they're cheering him on. And he's putting all his whole heart into it. This poorly drawn snake dragon thing. It's
like the tiniest limbs you've ever seen. Like, they're way too small for his body.
Yeah.
You should have given him, like, bigger claws or something to grab on.
Or wings. Just give him wings so he can fly up.
Yes.
Blame Kanjuro. He's just a terrible artist. And I like the end of the scene where, like, they're all crying for Ryunosuke because Ryunosuke starts turning back into a normal drawing. And then it, like, cuts back to, like, a wide shot and you just sort of see, like, the portrait of Ryunosuke in the sky by the sunset. And it's just, like,
it's sad. So sad. And then even Robin, who doesn't show emotion that often, is getting all teary-eyed.
Yeah.
I think Law doesn't give a shit. Does Zoro also not give a
shit? No, Zoro and Law are just like, it's the comedic effect here. Like, everyone else is, even Usopp, they're all getting into, like, you know, Ryunosuke's, you know, his final act as a, you know, as a living being was this heroic deed that he did. And then Law and Zoro are like, get over it.
It's just a drawing. It's a
drawing.
It's great.
I felt like this whole section was clearly, like, stretched a bit, but I'm like, this is amusing enough at the end here. I'm fine with it.
Yeah, this is very on brand for One Piece and Oda's comedy, so I liked it too. This is all from the manga. I remember this. So anyway, we come back from the commercial break, and everyone is heading towards the front gates of Zoe. And then the little coda onto that scene is that we see everyone's kind of walking up there, except for Robin, who decides to plant little flowers in Ryunosuke's honor by his body, I guess. And that's when we see, like, the front, like, outer wall of the Kingdom of Zoe, and then Luffy kind of jumps up and gets up to a really high point where he can get a good view and he can see the whole kingdom. It's like a big town, and then there's like a forest, and then far off in the distance he sees this giant tree that has the shape of a whale.
Yep.
And as they're walking in, some of the other guys are kind of noticing, like, this is strange. Like, this gate hasn't just fallen down from old use or whatever. This has been, like, recently smashed in.
Yeah, they're basically chatting here that, you know, the gate's been smashed down. There's now, like, a trail of, like, debris there. And they even note that it seemed like it was recent. Like, this isn't just, you know, the, you know, decay from time. This is, like, some, like, intentional damage from probably in the last day or whatever recently.
Yeah, Frankie even says he can smell gunpowder in the air and gas.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Something must have happened recently that's caused all this destruction. They see giant footprints on the ground as well. And as they're walking through the first part of the forest, we cut away briefly and we see someone is secretly watching them with a pair of binoculars. And as they're getting closer, Law and Zoro just suddenly freeze in place and they start to draw their swords. And they're like, everyone else is like, what? And it's like, oh, they sense something. Someone's coming. And this is when the Mink tribe attacks. And we see a white bunny girl come flying at Zoro. But to everyone's surprise, including Zoro's, he swipes at her and she just effortlessly flips and just zips over the top of him.
She's got double jump powers. Yeah, she could jump in midair.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to note here, this is Zoro we're talking about.
Yeah.
And she's like, boop, can't hit me.
This is about the only part, only thing of I've learned from osmosis from this arc is that there's a bunny girl named Kit. I know that people wanted her to be a Straw Hat, but for some reason or another, that doesn't happen. So, like, I'm spoiled on that, that she doesn't become a Straw Hat.
I know, but she sticks around for a long time and, like,
right.
Enough to the point where people were like, oh, she's going to join the crew, obviously, because Oda wouldn't tease us like that for, like, 1,000 chapters. And then Oda was like, you know, troll face or something.
There was even a thread on Resetera, just on the normal Etcetera forum, which is like their off-topic stuff, that was just like characters that were written off that you wish would like be brought back somehow. And one person did mention Carrot. Mm-hmm. I don't know if she's like written off, but kind of just that general thing where just like people, even in just a very general thread like that, talking about any show from anywhere, just like someone's like, I wish Carrot stuck around even longer. So that's like the only bit of osmosis that I have here is that she's around for a while. She's not around like permanently. So I know that. I don't know, you know, anything about the context about like her as a character or why she doesn't stick around. But that's like the only thing I have any sort of.
I mean, like, my understanding, I could be wrong, but my understanding, she actually sticks through all the way through Wano, which is like 500 episodes from now or something. Is that correct understanding?
Yes.
Like, she's around for a long time.
Yeah. All I'll say is that I was equally bummed that she didn't become a Straw Hat. But I will also premise that by saying, don't expect her to be the most amazing character ever. So, like, I can understand both sides of the argument, but I kind of personally would have liked her to be on the crew.
But, like, even so, even whether or not a character becomes a Straw Hat or not, like, Kinemon's been around for quite a while now, too. And, you know,
Yeah. He's
not a Straw Hat, but he's just kind of always been around. Now, I don't know if he'll stick around. Maybe he's got kicked out of this arc in this episode. I don't know, but he's been around.
He clearly wants to return to Wano, so he's going to be there till at least then.
Yeah.
That's the end goal for him. Right.
So, yeah, you know, sometimes you have these sort of tag-alongs.
Yeah. Characters. So, like, Wano marks the end of a major, what they call, it's not an arc, it's called a saga. So there are like major sagas in One Piece, and the end of Wano is the end of one of the sagas. And then we're now in the manga, we're now in what's called the final saga. And when that happens, a lot of these sort of things with like Kinemon and Carrot and other things kind of get resolved before we move on.
I mean,
so
we Law basically from even before, you know, Dressrosa, I think after Fishman Island, you know, Law and Luffy basically somewhere in
Punk Hazard.
Yeah. Basically like, we're going to take down Kaido. And like, that's the goal right now. And it's going to take us several arcs, including all of Dressrosa, to get to that goal. So that makes sense that like Wano, which is where Kaido is. And I, you know, don't know exactly what happens there, but I know that makes sense to be like, that's their goal right now, but we have to take all these side quests to get there.
Oh, so, you know, I bet what happens in Wano, I bet they beat Kaido.
Probably. That's a good bet.
I'm not going to say. Anyway.
Kaido becomes a Straw Hat.
Kaido is a new member of the crew. And I mean, I will tell you this. There's another really amazing character who's introduced in Wano, who's also another, why didn't they become a Straw Hat? So yeah, you have that to look forward to.
I will say I know about the other character too, because a friend of mine is a huge fan of that character and is also like kind of pissed when they didn't join. So I also like, they're all over the internet too. So just like Gear 5, I know about that because I was all over the internet. So
yeah, better left unsaid. But yes, I know. I'm not surprised, you know. But anyway.
But anyways, here's our formal introduction to Carrot.
Yes.
We even know her name now. Because the other character yells Carrot. Now, the other character, I don't think we have their name, but they show up. They look more like a deer of some sort.
We know their name. It's clearly Nami who got transformed into a dog girl, obviously. Yeah,
they're wearing Nami's clothes, like just her top, her two-piece top. And like, okay, the implication seems to be like, did Nami turn into this character or did this character steal her top for some reason? We don't know. But they point that out, that she's wearing Nami's basically top. Yeah.
It's like, what happened to Nami? Dun, dun, dun.
It's clearly she took Nami's top. It's clearly not Nami as a dog girl, but it'd be pretty funny if it was Nami as a dog girl.
But even if she took the top, like, why?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, that's definitely like big question marks.
Like, why did you take her clothes? You don't have her own clothes. So what's Nami wearing now? Nothing. That seems weird.
So yeah, this other character who, again, is not named yet.
She's riding a big, like, whale alligator fish thing.
Elephant thing? Yes. Kind of looked like, too. I don't know. It's like,
an alligator.
It's like an alligator fish.
Yeah, it's a...
It's really just a fat alligator, as I think is what it is.
It looked like it's like an alligator, but it's like really short. Like, the body doesn't look like an alligator body.
Actually, I think about it, like, you could say, like, everything was going fine until the mink tribe attacked. And then you got even, like, these hybrid animals. Because, like, obviously, hybrid animals are a big thing in Avatar. And now we've got some weird hybrid animals here, too.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm just writing down that name of our episode there. And she does call out something here, and this is where we learn the rabbit's name is Carrot. She goes, Carrot, stop. Yeah. We don't have time for this right now. We got to get back to such and so forth. Let's go. And then that's where we cut to the end of the episode. And that's when they see that, wait a minute, that dog girl is wearing Nami's clothes.
Was she a dog? Like, I you know, it was pretty quick. But it looked more like a deer to me.
Yeah, like dog ears, right? Like poodle ears, kind of?
She's a dog, yeah.
Okay. I was thinking more like almost like chopper-ish in a sense, but maybe not.
So, first impressions of Zoe.
I'm curious to see what's up with these characters and, you know, what's going on here. Because we don't know anything about this place other than it's, you know, been around forever.
Yeah, some important threads are, like, clearly about to be laid down. And so, like, I'm just curious to see how they all play out.
Yeah, I'm excited to rewatch this.
Also, Toei's stretching was annoying. Like, I think we got a little too much Ryunosuke. Like, that could have been shortened up a little bit, but I don't know, whatever, besides that.
Aside from the very beginning, which I do agree might have been a little fillerish, that was pretty accurate to the manga, so I think that was just Oda having fun. So we had to spend half an episode on that. But yeah, we are there and stuff is happening and there's going to be a lot more stuff that's happening very soon. So stick around for more mysteries to be answered. All right. Well, that's it for the rundown. Do we have anything this week that we felt was worthy of a flavor alert?
Flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
Maybe Rin being a big, like a... big bro in a good big bro Rin, maybe? I don't know.
As a moment?
I don't know. It's just something that came to mind.
Or Rin as a character. I mean, this year we've now gone through like two and we're going to have gone through three seasons of Blue Exorcist.
Rin was already nominated for like best male character anyway, right?
Well, did we nominate him, Rin?
I think
the only
one
we had was Izumo. I'm trying to find our...
Yeah, we've got to scroll up quite a bit here.
Yeah, I guess it's not clear who gets automatically nominated and who we have to like manually nominate.
Well, we don't really automatically nominate anyone. So yeah, I'm looking at best character male. We have Renzo in there. I think we decided like Renzo, we didn't know if he was, you know, necessarily a good character, but he was kind of an interesting character in that last season. So we nominated him and we have Izumo for best character female. So we don't have Rin. I don't know if we maybe want to hold off. I mean, we don't have that many weeks left in this year for nominations, but...
Yeah, we could do it.
Yeah, sure, why not?
He's definitely been growing as a character. Like, we're becoming well familiarized with more and more facets of him. He's definitely progressed from, like, screechy, yelly, shonen, you know, Asta-tier character to more of, like, a well-rounded figure over time, so...
Let's see here.
We have Mephisto in Best Villain, which I think is fair.
Yes, he's a contender.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of the other... So in Bleach, any of the powers, like for best power ability or weapon, Ichibei's ink
black
or Senju Maru's Bankai.
That one was pretty dope. I mean, I don't know. I mean, let's put it this way. It did defeat like six people or something.
I have a feeling that's not going to stick, knowing Bleach, but it was still a pretty like sophisticated, impressive ability.
I think both of those were impressive displays by both Senjumaru and Ichibei. Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. Why not?
Because I don't think if it sticks can be like, I feel there's a lot of powers that get nominated, but like they don't actually finish the job because it's shown in anime and like you can never finish the job until the main character does most of the time. So I don't know if that's.
Oh, okay. This will give me an opportunity to write this name down. This ridiculous name.
Shatatsu Karagara Shigarami no Tsuji.
In fact, you know what? I'm looking at this. I swore it was longer than this, but maybe it was just my memory.
Well, then it's the Bankai is called Shatatsu Karagara Shigarami no Tsuji. But then, like, the room that she creates is called Shide no Roku Shiki Ukeman no Hata. And then on top of that is the Hitokase Tokuba Banra no Me, and then the five other like rooms. So there's the name of the Bankai. Then there's the name of the, what it translates to, the loom of the six colored floating patterns of death.
I'm going to go with just her Bankai name here. But
and then, yeah. So that's just like the first part of like this kind of like these three names or four names for like that's each insane. Room that she had to like, chant or whatever.
I mean, I'm kind of being like cheeky here, but like I'm happy that they used the actual name and they said it in Japanese and everything. Like I think that doesn't need to be translated. That's fine, but it is just kind of funny because it's like my God.
Yes, but so especially long. When it's kind of just back to back to back. When you're watching an English dub, like oh, we just learned like we had got three different complex names in a row, and like the wiki here has like kind of literal translations, and some of these must be like references to like I guess lore or mythology or something. Like the name of her Bankai, like the translation that it gives is in English, crossing of Saha's gate, Kala's corpse, and piercing entanglements. I don't know what Saha or Kala are. They're linked. I don't know what they are, but they must be some reference. And then, like, the room that she creates, like I said before, is Loom of the Six Colored Floating Patterns of Death. Which that sounds pretty cool. And then so on and so forth. But yeah, that ability, we can nominate it.
What about Ryunosuke as a best ability?
No.
Best character.
Well, which would it be? That's the question.
Neither. I mean, he's dead, okay, right?
We don't have to.
Yeah. Best moment, Ryunosuke's sacrifice.
We were laughing. Is it worth it? I don't care.
Nah, it was fun, but nah.
Too cheesy. Okay.
Like, obviously, it was supposed to be cheesy, but still.
Well, I did remember.
Okay, let's see. Anything?
It's not. I don't think it's worthy of nomination, but I do remember that the old woman from the Blixers episode, she's actually, her character design is a reference to, I think, that old anime, like Gege's World or something. Like, mm-hmm.
I noticed that too.
I forget the name of the anime. Mentioned that. But it's a pretty infamous anime. I think it even got a remake recently. But that character design was a very specific reference. Not that I think it's worthy of nomination, but I do think it's worthy of mentioning at least that character design was a specific reference to a classic.
I liked that running gag in the episode. I thought that was fun.
I mean, yeah, if you're going to be a weird granny, it's better to be a accepting progressive weird granny than like a bigeted weird granny. So,
I think also I like too just the way she, not just the way she looked, but the way she like spoke and everything. It was just like, it wasn't, I don't want to say creepy because it wasn't creepy. It was just very, I don't know how to describe it. It was just very unique.
Ethereal, kind of? Ephemeral?
Huh?
Like kind of ephemeral or ethereal, kind of like.
I don't know. She was just like, sort of like very nonplussed, but also like secretly being a wingman, and it was just, I don't know, it was interesting. Okay.
One question I had here, when he says for worst moment, Izumo's mom saves his day, is that just referring to when Izumo took the mom took the curse back and just, like, I guess died?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, it was like didn't let Izumo get her own moment to shine. Basically, she was saved, basically, kind of in a weird, lame way. The issue.
Yeah, I don't want to go too much into it, but yeah, it was that combined with the fact that, like, it wasn't earned, and it was just a quick solution to the problem that came out of nowhere. There was just lots of problems with that moment.
Yeah, I guess Immortal Ninetales was not so moral after all.
All right. Well, I think that'll do it for this episode. I want to thank you guys for being here. Thank you, Seda.
Yep, no problem.
And thank you, Crocodile.
My pleasure, as always.
All right. We've got the same lineup this coming weekend, so check back with us next week for episode 452. And until then, later.